Welcome to Unraveling Midlife. I'm your host, Sarah Spence. Thanks for joining me as I explore my own astrological midlife by speaking with all sorts of inspiring people about their life and work. Astrological midlife relates to Western astrology transits that run from the mid-30s to the mid-40s for everyone. Each of the main midlife transits have an overall theme, though details do vary by generation and by individual. It does directly correspond to that term, midlife crisis, though I do like to call it the midlife unravelling. So far, this podcast has been me unravelling my time, living it, with these astrology transits, and I talk to others who've gone through them or are currently in the midst, as is today's guest. If you're new to the show, welcome. Be aware that at the end of the episode, I share a track of my original music. And you can check out the show notes for the links mentioned during this episode by scrolling down on your podcast provider. Today, we have Mataora Rongoa Hoteke, and he's a bit of an enigma. His online presence is limited, but in quite a few communities, a lot of people know him. He's quoted in newspapers, appeared in 4 documentaries. Mataora is most known for his ability to hold space and contribute to authenticity and peace within community. Based in the Bay of Plenty, Mataora is a health and medicine facilitator and martial artist, amongst many other roles, as you'll hear. He has studied Chinese medicine, Maori medicine, and Western medicine, the latter in a different way to many. Here he is, Mataora. Kia ora, Mataora. Welcome to Unraveling Midlife.
Kia ora, Sarah. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, you're a pretty interesting guy. I remember once you told me, when I said, I saw you in a documentary, you said, oh, I've been in a few of those. And I was like, okay, I clearly only kind of see you in some spheres, but there's so much more to you. So can you tell us a little bit about you? Well, how would you describe yourself?
So first and foremost, I always, in my present state of who I choose to characterize myself as being, is first and foremost as a father. Second, as like a guide, a helper, an assistant of health and medicine. Health and medicine facilitator is the label I give it and mold it to be. And then just a carer, a lover, a good person, good friend. That's how I like to see myself, yeah, and striving to be better. That's probably the best way to frame it for me. But what that may look like in the 3D or in the physical world, as we like to label things, I'm an acupuncturist, studied in China, but got my qualifications here in New Zealand. I've also studied Maori medicine, studied Western medicine, almost to a nurse's degree, but minus the pharmaceuticals, because it didn't require it. But we studied pharmaceuticals from an alternative perspective. And a martial artist, that led me actually into the world of medicine or healing, so to speak, healing myself first and foremost. And it comes from one of my masters who said to me, one of my very first masters, he said to me, the best martial artist is a doctor. And I pondered what that meant and later on questioned him. And I still couldn't work it out. And he goes, why is that? And in the end, the gist of it was that they show each other the two soundboards, the two different extremes that give you the contrast to be able to find middle ground or balance or harmony. So he said to me, the doctor knows how the body works and the martial artist knows how the body doesn't work. So the construction and the destruction. And meaning like if you want to break the arm, you know that it should go the way it doesn't work, and then you're going to achieve something, But that's the destruction. And then the healer would know the opposite, how the body does work and how we want to keep it working in that way. So the best one to find the soundboards, once you know how the body really works, then you're also going to know how it doesn't work and vice versa.
Yeah.
So that led me down this path. So for a very long time, I sat in the Libran, sun sign, believe that just because of general astrology put me there. But then after I looked deeper, put my proper birth time in, which was still 4 hours out, but that was the time that I was told and given. After lots of research and finding, it came down to 6:03 in the morning. And so for a long time, I emphasized Libra rising as well. And so it was Libra. But then there was, in my studies, I had this urge and this notion that pulled me towards the Scorpion constellation. And I always thought there's a huge element there because I'm a Cusperian. You know, I'm on the 22nd. But in the Northern Hemisphere, that's the 23rd, you know? So it was kind of like,
your sun's looking like it's 28 degrees. It's not 29. It's actually not quite on the cusp.
But that's what I mean. Like, since I was born at a different, I got 11 o'clock is my correct time. 11:01. Is that what you're pulling the chart from?
Well, I've got my app and I had your 11:01. Then you just told me 6:03. So I changed it.
No, but 11:01 is that's what I thought for almost 15 years.
Yeah.
Until my mother found my birth card and it was 11:01 in the morning. So it was,
makes so much more sense.
There's so many hours out. And that made a huge difference, like made me like even change houses slightly, you know. Even my moon going to Aries, you know, from Pisces, it was like,
hang on, it went back into Pisces. So yeah, that makes a lot more sense for you. But we won't get in too much into the specifics because the reader can't see your chart. But you like birth time is really important. Take that bit away.
Absolutely. The point being how there was all these shifts and changes through, but always been feeling that I was sleeping through most of that time until I hit like my 30s, you know, and I started looking a little bit deeper and so forth. And yeah,
it's not all about the sun sign.
I expanded, exactly. I started doing moon study and then seeing all of the signs being a huge part of me.
Yeah. You can see with a Scorpio ascendant that you're into deep things, and you've got your sun now in the 12th house, which is kind of the unseen, kind of like a bit of an enigma almost. So that's why I wanted to talk to you. And I know that you're big on community, right? You're a member of quite a few different communities. I know that when we had Earthbeat Festival and we got stuck in a spot where we're like, oh, we need someone to run a men's circle, I thought, oh, would you do it? And you kindly agreed, and we were so grateful for that. What I find interesting in your chart is that your south node, which is kind of the strengths you come in with in the past, is in Aquarius, which is all about community. In fact, it's right on where my sun is. And so like coming in with that strength of being community and networks, and then this life kind of to also embrace the opposite of kind of coming more into your own kind of individuality in the 10th house standing of community, which I found quite interesting. And it makes much more sense than that other time that I had for you. tell me about communities, why they're important to you.
Well, I mean, it's always been a thing since I was like 16. I wanted to live in a commune. And it's been quite interesting because my family has been quite private and closed for a lot of the time. And it's just emphasized the fact that I wanted to break out into these spaces, which I generally felt were places of transformation or feeling free of exploration and expansion. So I've always been, since I was 16, I wanted to do my own commune and stuff like that, which hasn't come to be. even yet, but I've been a part of a lot of communities and communes and stuff like that through Coromandel and so forth. And so the festival scene was kind of like a mobile, temporary form of these communes that were being created that were actually really speaking towards a lot of my visions and my dreams. Like, there were times where I saw things that I had visioned and dreamed to be in the commune that were surfacing and popping up, almost like the same vision, like it was a deja vu kind of experience, but it wasn't. But it felt like a deja vu by a lot of these, like, for example, Tanglewood. They had a ship there, you know, that was a accommodation. And for so long, as a part of my vision as a to build and be a part of a community, was to be in the elements. And one of those elements was to be the water element. So there would be a boat city there. And that was like, seeing that was like, wow, because it was to be lots of boats or repaired boats, and to create business where people could work on boats, put boats back in the water, ones that couldn't go back, they'd become accommodation on the land for Boat City, for Tangaroa's domain, the god of the ocean.
So is this your vision, or was this at Tanglewood, which we had an NZ Spirit Festival, a couple of
this
them,
was my vision, but your I vision. Saw my vision fruiting and in the flesh. And Tanglewood. Yeah.
Oh, great.
The element thing wasn't there. They just had an accommodation in the pirate's boat. For me, it just struck home to my vision.
I'm not surprised, because I saw that you've got a green trine and water in your chart.
Water element is a very big healer for me, for sure. Yeah, go to the water a lot for peace.
Yeah. Yeah, I think many of us do. Yeah, I also love the mountains, though. I've got an earth green trine in there as well, and air. So yeah, I think it's more about having the fresh air for me. So, I mean, you mentioned, yeah, you want to be part of a commune. I mean, in my observations, like, creating community is tricky. There's a lot of different personalities. I mean, I've gone to meetings and I've looked at things and I'm like, yeah, what are the entry criteria? What's the exit criteria? And then knowing people that have, I know several lots of people that end up in court fighting for what they feel is theirs. Who knows what? Like, I'll just leave that to the judges. I don't know who's in the wrong or right. Like, what are the qualities that are really important for even considering living with other people, not just living, because just living, like, I've lived in ashrams, yoga centers, but getting financially involved. I mean, this is just a conversation kind of question as it comes out as I start thinking about it. Yeah, I think that's where the challenge lies, isn't it?
Yes.
People, who'd have them?
I just had some technical difficulties. Hope that's all right. Yeah, absolutely. It's the biggest concern to any communing and congregating and coming together, is how do we relate? And I think the key is, and it's just a part of being a good person, really, is to be honest, to communicate as best as we can, and kindness, to stay open, you know, and to reduce isolation, because as soon as we start isolating, we can go off into story rather than seeing what's actually taking place. Being open to be able to receive criticism and make it constructive, being open to actually acknowledging every single point of view and comment, and see how it can fit in the circle, you know, because I just see everyone's point as just being a piece to the circle. And the stronger the circle, the, you know, like, if we look at a TP, the more pieces of bamboo or branches that we put up for the teepee, the stronger it is, you know. But it also becomes heavier as well. Yeah. So, yeah. About working together is key, and all those qualities will help us do that. I truly believe that.
And a lot of patience, hey? It's quite a Libra answer you've given me, you know, and being balanced and getting
I've been practicing that one for a while. but, yeah, I mean, I see a lot of my pinnacle in life now is coming down to what we say in Māori is what is the most important thing in the world. Hea hatu me nui ki te ao. And it's he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It's the people, it's the people, the people. So that means our relating and how we connect is the key. And if we do have good connections between each other, then we're going to build really strong connections in the physical manifestations of the communities and the spaces that we build in.
And so how does like tikanga kind of come into your vision of community? Can you tell us about, I'm not even sure if that's the right question.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So tikanga is like protocols, rules, guidelines, and so forth. And they're really important. I believe that without them, people run astray. People lose track sometimes. So they bring us back on track to what we've all chosen, you know, like mission statements, so to speak. They're crucial and important. So, yeah, tikanga is super important. And, you know, setting forth all of these practices and these rules and these regulations keeps us safe. It's like boundaries is something that I wanted to say earlier. But, yeah, boundaries are key. If we set boundaries really strongly, then we may have a small group. But if we have loose boundaries, then we have a bigger group. And often a lot of things play up a lot when we mix the energy together, different types of ways, then we have a mixed result. This is what I found in the festival scene. Whereas in where we may go to something that's still kind of considered festive, but maybe has more stricter guidelines, you know, no alcohol and all these kinds of things, there's generally a smaller group and it's a lot cleaner outcomes and results, but not always across the board. But yeah, I think this is important to acknowledge and witness when we speak about community and setting standards in communities, because we can see different flavors in the festivals, different flavors in different communes and different retreats. And they're all necessary. I believe they're necessary because we don't see one person that looks the same, so we're not going to want the same experience.
How do we deal with aspects of community that are uncomfortable?
The same thing, I reckon. We have to speak to it as soon as possible in the kindest way. So if we don't have anything nice to say, the quicker we find something nice, the positive aspect of making our argument constructive or useful in some ways. But sometimes we don't know what that means, so we just have to throw it out as it is. But we can still present it in a way that it will be received the best way it can under those pretenses. So good conversation. You know, MVP is a really good example, you know, but a lot of people just aren't trained in this because society has trained us to be aggressive communicators.
Did you say like NVC, like nonviolent communication? Is that what
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I said P because I'm programmed to have a program every week. It's called MVP. NVC, violent communication. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's, I think that's a question might come back to, maybe with a panel someday.
Yeah, but I believe that's key, is we present it, because otherwise it may fester and become something else. So present it as quickly as we can in the nicest way we can. And that's going to show respect. That's going to show, you know, the awareness.
Speaking of respect and awareness, I just wanted to backtrack a bit, because I didn't ask them when you were telling us about martial arts, because there's a lot of respect, a lot of awareness, and some martial arts kind of really go with the flow, and some are different. Like, what martial arts did you get involved with? How did you kind of, I mean, I know that you teach some as well, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's quite a long story, because it's the gist of, you know, the birth and of all of this for me. Always had an interest since I was young, but it was always very expensive to study or do martial arts. So the next best thing was martial arts movies and playing around with your cousins, until we had a martial arts startup at our school. It was kind of like $5 a class back in the day. So that was kind of like something out of reach, you know, even if it was just one class a week and I can go practice all the stuff throughout the week. But then one class became two, became three. The next minute, after a few years, I'm doing 10 classes in a week. just loving it. It was trauma release. It was something that I could attach to that gave me peace and clarity, where the aggression that was in me could be channeled. Because it was quite difficult as a youth. But these martial arts, really, all those rules and those awarenesses really gave me a beautiful soundboard in life to be able to navigate good choices and clear choices. And I believe that that led me into medicine, which gave me an even clearer understanding of what's right or wrong or best or more ideal for my body under the circumstances and pretenses. And really gave me great navigation. And I'm thankful and gifted because able to share that with others. But a lot of the things that I used to say, even back then, as a teenager, people would come to me for advice and help, but a lot more people would disregard what I had to say back then because of what I felt was my age. I was saying the same stuff, thinking the same things, really similar knowledge, but only when I reached around 30 did I notice a huge difference in people being able to really reciprocate the knowledge and hear what I'm saying to them. Yeah.
Of course, that age being quite significant in both Western astrology and human design that we're both involved in too, right? So that Saturn return kind of maturity, like a different standing in the world. Yeah,
I did start to see it earlier, like around 27 and stuff like that, but I may have been masquerading to a degree, like wearing shirts while I was young and had seeing glasses and, you know, like all these kinds of things. But I felt like I wasn't just an act. I was like, I needed them at times.
Yeah. Are you saying glasses are bad? Are not cool or something?
it was just the thing that I put on that made me feel older.
Oh, right.
Noticed when I didn't have them on, people thought I was younger, but when I had them on, people would acknowledge me being older.
And did you have a baby face?
Wiser. I still have a baby face.
I know.
So do you.
And so, like, because sometimes those transits, which is like when Saturn comes back to where it was in your chart, Saturn return. I mean, you know, they are not just, you know, I mean, if you look at the ephemeris that shows all the planetary movements, it might look like it only lasts 3 weeks, but there's such it can last a lot longer, you know, like in influence coming up, and of course there's other things happening in your chart as well. But there's that midlife, astrological midlife, which is what this podcast's a bit about. Well, it's meant to be a lot about, but these days it's just like, you know, some of what we talk about. So we've got that like kind of late 30s, mid 30s for some, but late 30s for others. Just depends where the planets were when you're born, to the mid 40s. And I know that you're kind of you're in the midlife. And sorry, you may be a midnight. I've got someone, one of someone else that I interviewed was, she didn't want to, like, I feel like it's limiting if we call this midlife.
You can see my smile, eh? That's what you're saying, you know, like, oh, bloody
Yeah.
100, so, you know,
Yeah,
like.
yeah. Well, this phase in life that some call astrological midlife, this phase is, you know, it is a long one too.
Most Qigong masters, Tai Chi masters would live till like 200, 300, they reckon.
Oh, cool. So yeah, you'd have things, you'd have some of these transits again, but like I'm not sure if they would all happen around like the same time, you know, again.
Yeah, it's a
So
fascinating approach to like shift what a lifetime would be and look like.
yeah, so I mean, I know for me, if I look back to when I started, at that time with Pluto being 90 degrees to where it was, I mean, I was making the choice to leave the city that I grew up in and had lived in for most of, not all, but a good chunk of my adult life, probably at least two thirds of my life. And for you, that kind of would have started, you know, maybe a year or so before COVID hit and we all locked down and all that kind of thing. How
I loved it.
has your life and kind of unraveled in that time, you know? What's been the change in the last 5 years?
So definition more than anything, you know, definition and confirmation. Where, so for example, the first week of COVID, it got me, you know, like it fully got me, and I grabbed onto it and held on as well. And yeah, so I had my children together and sat them down and started like telling them about all the different ideas and rules and the things that we need to upkeep with this COVID around. You know, like one example would be make sure we don't touch everything and stuff like that. Because, and then at the end of it, once I went through this list of stuff, which was kind of like the list that they had given us, this was still the very first week, it was fresh. And they were like, Dad, you've already taught us all that stuff. And I was like, oh. Then I kind of was like, yeah, I trained my children to like follow these kinds of things. And I would call it natural hygiene, you know, that keeps you from getting sick, really, is like touching everything, putting your hands in your mouth and stuff like that. So this was a huge part of it. And they just said, you taught. And then I just found out as soon as they said that, I was like, hey, we're going to be fine, you know, like as soon as I, like, because if they're already clued up, then we're going to be fine, really, you know, because a lot of other people were, this was the first time that they ever considered these basic rules and stuff like that. So it was definition and confirmation that what I had chosen to live my life as, you know, was already had set me up for these kinds of things. My diet, the way of eating, where everyone was jumping on the wagon to do all these health and fad things. And I was just like, I've been doing this already for decades, you know? So it was more like confirmation and so forth. And a big one that came from it for me was relief. It was a huge relief because all these people were like, because it was around the time where I was getting caught in between wanting to go digitally, fully go digital, you know, with all of my information and knowledge that I had accumulated, and I thought it's time to share it. And then everyone started like going digital, and I was thankful because I'm glad I didn't go digital, you know, to a degree. Everyone was out there doing it and going digital and putting all this information and knowledge out. But then for me, I still feel it's a treasure, and it's not something that we do want to just throw out too easily and be misled and copycat and regurgitated in a way that it wasn't quite, because I've seen it too many times from ex-partners and so forth, that they go and use a lot of the stuff that spent me years and years and years to really comprehend, and then they would go and use it like 10 minutes later or a month later or something, and not in the right way, not in the right context, and yeah, it just felt not right. And I shared the information for it to be used, but in a way, you know, and it takes time to be able to really get there. So COVID was a lot of realization in that, you know, through the digital stuff as well. So I could keep it more authentic and in real time, because the battle I had between going digital and just keeping it like in person, one-on-one in groups and stuff like that, was that you're able to share more and then able to get more like returns, so to speak, financial cash flow. But then this one-on-one, it's a more cherished, it's a more beautiful approach, and you can have reassurance that the information is going to be transmitted well and received well and kept well, because they can see the authenticity in you, and that's the approach, and you can see the authenticity in them and their intentions, you know? Yeah. So COVID taught me a lot about, about that and confirmation and what I knew. But I had already, almost slightly a decade before, I had, my daughter was in a serious car accident for like 7-8 months in hospital. And that was the real confirmation and acknowledgement that I went through with COVID, just as a reminder that I really went through everything that I had known and been taught. I was able to really implement. I dropped everything, and she was my only patient, and probably to the detriment of a lot of things, like my partnership at the time. And But the thing was, is that in that space, I was able to really navigate. Like, they were trying to, this was before COVID and everything, and I hadn't vaccinated my children, you know, at all. So, you know, COVID was going to be like, hang on a sec, you know, like, they haven't even had like flu shots and everything like that. So they haven't had the measles, the mumps, and the German measles and stuff like that. They didn't have any of that, you know, or rubella, or, you know, like I did. And we had huge arguments with the doctors about them trying to get it in there, but there's a 6% chance. And I said, well, 6% chance that they're going to get sick, you know, it's not a chance that I'm willing to take, especially when I know already, when I've got a 9-year-old child that hasn't had vaccinations and is actually presents in comparison to his classmates and his cousins and so forth, barely gets sick compared to those who have been vaccinated. And I can understand how it's necessary for some population who don't live the way that we choose to live, which is good diet, good exercise, try to keep our minds clean and healthy as much as possible. I don't know if we really need to step into that world, you know, of mass vaccinations. Those who want to be mass vaccinated, I totally get it. I get it. Under those pretenses, if you eat a certain way, live a certain way, don't care to do certain things, you need to be, you know, vaccinated, really, to a degree. To a degree. I still would prefer no one did, but that's a choice. My choice is, I'm not into it, because we have already our own practices that keep us healthy and safe from that. And I've barely gotten sick, and they told me all sorts of stories about what I'm going to catch when I go overseas, especially through Asia. And I didn't get anything, maybe a slight sore stomach now and then. And I lived there for almost 10 years. And I did the same thing. I did the best to eat well. I became vegan and more vegetarian over there than here, just because the quality of the food was nothing like New Zealand. So, yeah.
You mean the quality of the meat? So the vegan was preferable? Or just the vegan food where you were living was just awesome?
No. Oh, well, they had more options, which didn't exist through other countries I had traveled. You know, like they would have Buddhist smorgasbords almost every street. So it'd be like, but some of it was a bit like fake meat and all that kind of stuff. This was like they've been doing it for 30 years or more, you know, but it would be delicious and it'd all be generally like this back in the day, you know. For a long time they didn't eat eggs and so forth and cheese and all that because it's a part of the some Buddhist traditions, you know, that have been carried on.
And where in Asia was this? Was this Taiwan or?
This was Taiwan for the most part, but it was throughout other parts of Asia too, just not widespread. Yeah. Yeah, these Buddhist cafes were wonderful, you know. And so that helped egg along. And at the time, my Thai wife, she was a wonderful cook and she knew I would like vegetarian and so forth, and she would cook accordingly, you know, which is not too hard. She just could never believe like why you want to do that, but take those the yummiest parts out, gives it the flavor. But she would, yeah. And so it was easy in that regards. But yeah, it was mainly the flavors of the meat and the fish just taste like dirt. The fish
Oh,
taste mud and dirt, and the
muddy sea
meat.
over there, hey?
Yeah, and the meat just tasted like bland, dry and tasteless. Only when you got New Zealand lamb, but that was an arm and a leg, you know, and it wasn't common to be able to come across. You'd have to go to flash as restaurants and stuff. Yeah. So I went vegan, and it was also the movement in the initial stages of vegan getting really popular as well. So it was my exploration because generally I would always say, if I was to share and provide information and knowledge for clients, patients, or family, that I must test and trial the information and the knowledge before I would share it with others, live it. And so I would do these things before I'd suggest them, just to make sure, you know. Yeah.
So, do you recommend a vegan diet now?
Under pretenses, but not really. But I would say my best response would be how I would do it. And I'm 70 to 85% vegan, you know, like, and I have lived that. But maybe in the past year, I've been a bit slack on that, maybe closer towards 60 to 80, you know. But to eat meat and maybe dairy products and the in-betweens, honey and stuff like that, but maybe so minuscule that it'd be hard to notice it. But that goes against, that's why I said maybe, because that will just blitz morals if you're doing it for the respect and honor of animals, right? Then it just doesn't go there. But in some ways, it's a good way to show honor and respect as well, because in our tradition and in our belief that we believe that animals, we work and coincide together, you know, and our existence is on. And for a long time, I'd still kept up the vegan thing, mainly focused on health. But then I also found that there was deficiencies that would come up. It's harder to truly have a good ideal diet. And for me personally, I got really thin. The benefits were lots of energy, like exuberant amounts of energy, and feeling light and increased positivity. But I noticed I'm already thin, and I already, you know, how people got called fat and teased for being fat. I felt the exact same thing for being skinny, you know, like I felt like getting teased all the time, like you're too skinny, you're too skinny all the time. So I would feel that insecurity built from that. So, you know, like losing more weight, doing something that was good, it was difficult. Yeah. So yes and no, I think veganism has its place and I do believe it's great. But the reality is it's rare to really find what you could be an idealistic or a true vegan, which would be someone that was brought up vegan from the beginning to the end, you know, till they die. It's quite rare, I think. You know, it's more like it's a choice, and people have eaten meat through their life, return to eating meat, maybe go back and forth, you know, to not really be a solid vegan. So I probably did like 10 years out of my 44 years. And I believe that it did save me and help me, and I will return to aspects of doing it. And you can consider it like fasting, selective fasting, or, you know, like water fasting or certain type of diet fasts and so forth, where you're selectively choosing to eat a certain way. Yeah, it's like a fast to a degree. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess like a lot of that would stem from your background in Chinese medicine as well. Like, I know that after I'd been vegetarian for 10 years, I started going to acupuncture, and they were encouraging me to eat some beef. And I was like, oh, I don't want to eat beef. And the same acupuncturists were encouraging my flatmate to eat lamb. And we were both like, neither of us wanted to eat meat at all. And then the yoga that we were following, the teacher had said, been known to say, if you're going to eat animal, eat something that has a light spirit. So we started with a little bit of venison, because that was kind of but then we ended up having chicken soup because it was easiest to cook. And it's hard, like, you know, it was like 17 to 27 not really eating meat and not cooking it, like only on occasion. Like, I still don't cook a lot of meat. It's just easier to make vegetarian, yeah, or have really good quality sausages, because sausages are easy.
I hear you, but I totally agree. And that experience as well, going through Chinese medicine, which believe that all different types of materia, you know, we call it the materia medica, you know, which is the herbal, I know they're not even the animal parts, but they still call it the herbology of Chinese medicine, you know, animal parts and everything. And this is a lot of people who have a problem with it, you know, and vegans push that a lot. But, you know, so it was difficult. How can you talk vegan but then practice Chinese medicine? And you can still practice the form of vegan Chinese medicine as well, which was quite interesting for a time being. But then I found and saw that other products were better in certain situations. And that's what those acupuncturists were saying. Yeah, we could get you there without it, but this is the fast track. And so for me, it's interesting that you said chicken soup, because that's where I would have led someone to, because by having my vegan experience and knowing how they feel and ooh, yuck, or how we could mediate that and get there. So I would suggest bone broth or chicken soup was one of my first. And it's actually one of the most powerful medicines, you know, energetically. And just to drink the soup, and then they just drink the soup because they're getting all of the solids in soup form. So it's actually really good for them, and they're getting all that nutrients in the marrow and so forth, the lymphids, and it's just a whole lot easier than actually chewing on some meat, you know? So yeah, those kinds of techniques, and maybe if they had experience of veganism, they would have known as well. So that trial and true worked for me in regards to being able to give better delivery to clientele and patients and so forth. Yeah.
Oh, I'm just thinking, because, you know, we're recording this, so the sun's just gone down and it's autumn and it's been a beautiful day, but gosh, some broth would be perfect as the days get colder.
And some ginger in there, and you know, yeah. Cinnamon.
I'm having a different thoughts about what I'm going to make for dinner.
Well, it's so important, because when we have society telling us to have, in New Zealand, roasts for, you know, like summer, and put tell us to put up a man all dressed up in long sleeves and a long beard and snow around. And it's the middle of summer. It's really can mess with your head, you know. And that can also mess with our digestive systems, which is this whole take that the world is inside out, upside down and topsy-turvy, you know. And that the truth just lies there present all the time for us. But we're missed by all of this inception and deception of information and knowledge that's shrouded over the truth, you know, in the screen, in images and magazines, books and sound and radio. And this makes it really hard for coming back to track with the community, because then that brings us off track to our core values and everything a lot of the time, you know. And so, like, once we give it time and space for us to brew and get to know each other and our culture, we're talking about tikanga, one of the most important things before anything, we get to know each other. Before we start chewing the fat, you know, we cook together and we learn about what that cooking and what we can produce together may look like before we even pick up the knives. So imagine picking up the knife straight off the bat and then getting into arguments that just escalate so much. So we get to know each other so we can work together. We call it whakawhanaungatanga, you know. And whanaunga is like families. Whanau is family. Yeah. And so bringing all of that together, you know, is the art or the ship, like citizenship and friendship and relationship, the ship of family, familyship, you know, whanaungatanga, whakawhanaungatanga. And that's the key part of everything.
I've worked at more than one organization that has that as one of their values.
I think it's crucial to being able to have a good community. And I do believe Māori values are a really good framework to be able to express a good community. Even though we may not present because of our injection into a different world, that, you know, like a colonized world, or being colonized into a colony, or being a colony put upon us, so to speak, or accepted and received, that it can create a little bit of confusion, you know, about us processing the old and the new. So it may not appear like we have the answers because of how we present in this world, but if we go back to our tradition, I believe that we can really represent what really good values for. And the reason I say that is because our focal point, the head of the boat, or we say in Māori, the tauihu, is heading in the direction of to be together. Whereas in modern society, often they may say Western society, but I think modern society is the correct term that's driving in its own force, in its own way, is focused on the individual, you know, on separation, so to speak, whether that's an individual family, you know, with an atomic family, a picket fence, you know, a car, a boat, and, you know, this, like, rather than a community, which would be sharing a boat, you know, because that's how Māori would do it. We couldn't have 100 boats out there, so we would all share the boats, and but would have to share the land, but would have our own spaces, you know. So it's very different where we're working, you know, the focus is that individual, like working for your job to do your thing to get your stuff, not working together, where you would see even a lot of other cultures injected into New Zealand, like Chinese, and I'm not being racist, it's just an observation, Chinese and Indian cultures, where the families work together and they actually achieve a lot doing that, you know. Māori work that way and operate that way, but we've been fragmented. And so we're not necessarily a good example, but we have good framework.
So, yeah, and we're working colonialism.
Together.
English
Yeah.
colloquialism.
And it's going to take some time, you know, and it's not about us or if all this blooming stuff that's come, it's all that. It's not that. It's about how we're learning to rejig and put all these pieces together so that we can take the good, you know. And the reason I say that is because since I was a child, I broke stuff, I wrecked it. You know, like I was, there was this toy, and I was curious like how it worked, and I couldn't see quite in there. So I would break it open, and then that would be the end of it. But it would be the beginning of my knowledge and my awareness of the mechanisms and the subtleties and the intricacies of the thing. And so it's been one of my gifts to be able to analyze and see into things. And I believe that these are crucial factors to a community, you know, as that's our focus point.
What
No matter what.
advice would you give to someone who wants to be more in community, or perhaps someone that doesn't come from that cultural background of all working together and is very much like the nuclear family individual?
I can't speak for anybody else, to be honest, but I could only say from my own experience what I did. And I think it's a good approach, maybe not a good result, but a good approach, which is to go and explore as many communities as you possibly can and take the best and bits of what you want, or look for the one that you can get the nearest to what feels right for you. So if you don't know what that is, write down all of the qualities that you want. You know, the pros and cons of a community, or pros and cons that you want out of a community, and then go exploring. And if I was to suggest a place of all places, I would say Tui Community, because it's been in New Zealand anyways. I would say go worldwide. I have unfortunately not had the opportunity yet to be able to explore communities throughout the world. But I hope to, because I still hope to one day be a part of a community that really hits home to what I would like. So explore communities, go to the Tui community in New Zealand, because, and that's in
Golden Bay.
Golden Bay, Nelson. It's been going for 30 years. It's a beautiful community of beautiful people that have made it work and have really good frameworks. And if you are interested, then Rubina does community boot camps to be able to give you the skills, the techniques to be able to really hit home you know what a community would work for you under your pretenses and what you would like. And they had one just that at Ariki and Tūmanako, and she was there I think 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
And it sounded amazing.
Rubina McCurdy's been known
Yeah.
for a long, long time. She was part of one of the founders of Tui Community,
Yeah,
and
beautiful
then
lady.
moved out at one point, is my understanding. But she, yeah,
Fair
she,
enough.
yeah, I like th things have their place. Like that's for the good great advice to go and check out different communities. And then there's others of us, like myself, I'm not convinced I want to live in that kind of a community, but I love being part of community in different ways. And even just, I love being part of a lot of different communities, which I unpack this with my therapist, because I'm like, I like being part of lots of different communities, but then some people in communities don't really take you seriously unless that's your only community. So it's like there's such a variety of people in life. So I find that we've dug into that
Nice.
a few times. Well, thanks so much for your time, Mata Ora. Now, if you're not digital, how do people find you?
Well, I am digital, just not full digital, you know, like putting it my guts out there and so forth. But you know, like if people interested, I would say probably connect on Instagram or something, because I believe that one's going to last longer than Facebook, and that's the Golden State Warrior Beast.
Sorry, say that slowly.
Golden State warrior beast, but it's like underscore. So that'll be like warrior underscore, oh no, golden underscore state underscore beast, warrior underscore beast.
Okay, I think I'll put that in the show notes. So at golden underscore state underscore warrior underscore beast.
Something like that.
Yeah. That golden state warrior beast. I think you should, you know, send that to me so I can make sure it's correct.
Golden state warrior beast.
So everyone, check the show notes, because it's a beast of an Instagram handle to handle the jandle.
Oh, mata ora rungua hōtoke, you know, for Facebook and stuff like that. Generally, check on there. You know, whether that's you're in Tauranga or something like that, and you want to a session or something like that, which may look like sitting down, looking and considering what it is as your major complaint, and doing our best to provide you with lifelong skills, techniques, and strategies to be able to alleviate, prevent, and get rid of that, cure in some ways. Maybe cure is not the right word, but that's what I will say, yeah. And for any other concerns in regards to health, yeah, this is my heart and my soul. So, yeah, welcome to contact me in regards. Thank you, Sarah, so much for taking the time and the space to connect. It's always wonderful to spend time, and I honor who you are and how you like to provide and share yourself with the world. It's really, truly beautiful to witness. So thank you for being here and connecting.
Thanks, mata ora. Welcome to the music section of the show. Today's track is a live track, the last one recorded by Shakti Sacred Music in the form of myself and Emma in January 2024 at the Ecstatic Dance Festival in Aungatete, Bay of Plenty, Aotearoa, New Zealand. It's called Deep Peace and is an original tune to a traditional Gaelic blessing.
Deep peace.
Unraveling Midlife is brought to you from Aotearoa New Zealand by www.sarahmarlowspence.com. Theme music is by Sarah Marlow Spence and Saraswati Marie Willis, and art by Samantha Hepburn.